Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
To the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest is Jennifer Lowenstein, and we hope to connect during part of this hour, if we can reach her in Tripoli, a former Congresswoman and Green Party presidential candidate, Cynthia McKinney. She is in a war zone, and in a war zone, there is fighting going on. It's coming out of the sky. We know what's going on. We've talked so much about it on this program. NATO bombing, and we'll sure talk more about it during this hour. But let me tell you about Jennifer. Jennifer teaches at the University of Wisconsin. She's also Associate Director of its Middle East Studies program. She's a board member of the Israeli Coalition Against House Demolitions, USA branch, founder of the Madison Raffer Sister City Project, and she's a freelance journalist. Jennifer, are we connected?
Yes, we are.
Oh, I am delighted. We'll see if we can get hold of Cynthia.
That would be fantastic.
I must tell you very briefly, back during Israel's Operation Cast Lead, the war against Gaza a couple of years back, I had scheduled two doctors in Gaza to come on my program. I got one of them later on because he had to go to some shelter because they were bombing right near where he lived. I got the other one on, and I heard the sounds of warfare in the background. It was a very, very disturbing, eerie feeling. I won't forget it.
No, and I know that. I know that sound, and it's, you know, I've been in war zones on numerous occasions, but for me, I've always known I could leave when I wanted. And what I can't begin to comprehend is the feeling that people in Libya or in Yemen or in Gaza feel, knowing that they are in the middle of a war zone. And many of them, most of them, in fact, have no place to go.
They sure don't. And, of course, the people of Gaza have been living in, it was called the world's largest open-air prison before the Hamas election, and then Israel imposed its blockade in mid-2007. It's now over 4 years old, just a little bit over 4 years old. It's shocking, Jennifer, that the rest of the world, including the Arab community, the European community, there have been a few outspoken world leaders, but generally the countries that could really do something about it have been complicit in their silence, letting this go on.
It's worse than that, if you don't mind if I cut in here for a moment. It's worse than that. I was recently looking through some articles that I had written with a friend back in 2003, and I found one on Gaza in which I was quoting one of the major human rights organizations or humanitarian aid organizations talking about the blockade of Gaza and how it was on the brink of a humanitarian disaster. And the point is that our memories are so short, are so limited, because of the coup in 2007, so-called coup, when U.S.-trained Palestinian security forces went into Gaza to try to oust the legally elected, democratically elected Hamas government from power. People trace the siege of Gaza, because it was tightened then, to 2007, when in fact there has been a siege on Gaza for over 20 years, and it has gradually tightened and been systematically tightened over those almost two decades, sometimes goods are a few more goods are allowed in, and sometimes it's a few less. But for the most part, since the outbreak of the Second Intifada, Gaza has been a prison. And it's just interesting to me to note how many people, interested, well-meaning, well-intentioned people, will talk about the siege as having started in 2007, when it didn't start then. It started in 1989. That's when the policy of closure began in the Gaza Strip. That's when the Israelis began systematic efforts of closing off the Gaza Strip to the rest, to Israel, to its economy, and thereby, as the scholar Sarah Roy put it, de-developed Gaza. Literally, they undeveloped what had been developed, and have prevented any kind of independent economy from growing since then.
It's just a real mess. I guess it only got worse 4 years ago. But you're right. In 1989, you're talking about the first Intifada period.
Right.
And of course, in the interim between then and now, we had the so-called Oslo Agreement. And I've quoted famed Palestinian American Edward Said a few times when he was invited to the White House ceremony, and he absolutely wanted no part of it.
He refused.
He was outraged. He was outraged. It was a surrender. It wasn't an agreement.
Right. Well, you know, and I will say that the Palestinian team under Arafat, they were not very savvy going into those talks. They didn't have the team of lawyers to help with the details of the language. I don't know what they were thinking, but if anybody reads non-mainstream news from 1993 on about what was going on in the territories, they get a much different picture than what was presented to the American public. For example, the Israeli journalist Amira Haas wrote an award-winning book called Drinking the Sea at Gaza, and it is a memoir of the year or year and a half that she spent living in the Gaza Strip in, I believe, 95, 96. And in that book, she details how dire the conditions were becoming in the Gaza Strip and how this ran counter to everything that was being reported in the news. Now, this is during the time when peace was supposedly on its way, when peace was supposedly budding and a final status agreement was going to be, was just around the corner. This is Amira Haas's book in the 90s, before the Second Intifada began. Now, if the conditions in Gaza, and I should also say the West Bank, were worsening at this time, imagine what they were like during the Intifada, during the disengagement, after the Hamas elections. I mean, I think people have such a tiny grasp of how long this process of suffocation and strangulation has been going on, and how terribly it has affected people, not only physically in terms of their health, but psychologically.
Oh, indeed so. I mean, I agree with that. And Amira Haas, for a number of years, lived in Gaza. I read that book, Jennifer. It's on my shelf. I've read Oh, gee, I've got so many. I forget. I think I read two of her books, but that I believe is the best known one.
Yeah.
And it's on my shelf. And I mean, she lived there. I mean, she didn't have to live there. She could live any place she wanted. A journalist for Haaretz, and she wanted to know firsthand what she was talking about. So she was there. She saw it. She was right there with the Palestinians going through the same things that they did every single day. And she told, because of that, she told the kind of story that you can't do unless you're right there.
Day by day,
day after day, going through it. And you remember
and my
back
question,
then,
why is there one Israeli journalist, one, who has ever lived in the territory? Why? To me, that's strange. I mean, there are some very good journalists. Gideon Levy, for example, is superb, and he certainly has spent a great deal of time. I wouldn't for a moment criticize his writing, but it just seems so strange to me that you have a country where the vast majority of its citizens, of its first-class citizens, have no idea what's going on in their own backyard and what their own government is inflicting on a whole nation.
And too many people in other places, especially here in America, Jennifer, don't know what's going on either. The numbers who do know something, not enough, but something, are growing. And I honestly believe that what Israel has been doing for decades is unsustainable. There is an end to this at some point. I don't know when. Nobody knows when, but it's coming. Nothing this horrendous, this lawless, this brutal. It simply cannot go on. And even the partnership between Washington and Israel. And I refer to it, America as Israel's paymaster partner, and we both know what we supply them year after year, billions of dollars in money and weapons and interest, low interest or free loans or just give them the money and they don't have to repay it. I mean, they get benefits nobody else in the world gets. And, I mean, just hand it to them. This tiny country, population-wise, maybe on the order of greater Chicago, a little bigger than that, and they get all of this, and they're a rogue state, and of course they brutalize Palestinians daily. They wage occasional wars against their neighbors. Lebanon would be the main one now. A few years ago, they bombed an alleged nuclear site in Syria that was not a nuclear site, and even the CIA later confirmed, I just quoted that in an article, as a matter of fact. I referred to U.S. intelligence. I think it was CIA, but the material I got said U.S. intelligence said there were North Korean supplied missiles there. It was not a nuclear site, and Israel knew it at the time. Oh, you bet your life they knew it. They know exactly what they're doing. So they lied about it, and the U.S. media lied about it. And 2007, I think it was, the Bush administration lied about it, and they're still lying about it. And the IAEA is going after Syria to come clean on its nuclear operation. Come clean? Ask Israel to come clean on its nuclear.
Is pretty glaring. I mean, it's very disturbing. I mean, I try sometimes to not lose my cool when I'm talking about this subject.
I can't contain. You know, instead of saying I can barely contain myself, Jennifer, I say I can't contain myself.
No, it's very disturbing. And my comment or my reaction to what you're saying is simply that I never go after Israel without reminding listeners that this rogue state, this outlaw state, is modeled after the number one rogue state or outlaw state in the world, and that's the United States. And I don't think that any genuine activist for Palestinian human rights, just for human rights, period, should ever forget that. Israel is not an anomaly. Israel is the creation of the United States to a great extent, certainly since 67, and its lawlessness and its the kind of state terror that it engages in, all of its policies have been engaged in previously by the United States, by the number one rogue state in the world. We can't forget that. The reason I say that is simply because when I tell my own child to look at herself first before criticizing other people, I want to tell activists the same thing. Look at the United States and what it's done and is doing before going after any other nation alone without attaching it to the number one supporter or subsidizer of the rogue state. And we can argue forever over whether the tail wags the dog or the dog wags the tail. I think it's a very complicated situation. I don't think that Israel controls the United States the way some people do. I think that's nonsense. But I certainly see how Israel is an arm, a major arm, the right hand, perhaps, of the United States. It does what it does because it's allowed to do it, because it is encouraged to do it, and because nobody has any intention, nobody in power, of telling it to stop.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, as long as they can get away with anything they wish, they do get away with it. And we both remember when Netanyahu was here, just when late May, and that sickening speech that I wrote an article quoting him from the speech. It was a sickening, insipid speech. And yet the Congress, just like, you know, 535 or so of them sitting there, senators and House representatives, and just fawning all over him. It was nauseating, like a visiting god.
I mean,
this monstrous man, they should have put him in handcuffs and thrown him behind bars.
Yes.
You know, whiplashed him or something.
Anybody else who has done the kind of things he has done or supported or encouraged is someone we think we talk about as needing to be sent to the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and he's getting accolades and applause at the U.S. Congress, the big echo chamber. It is nauseating. It's despicable. And you got to wonder, I wonder, how many of the people in Congress, how many of our congressmen and women and senators, how many of them really believe it? I don't know. I really don't know. How many of them really buy into it? Do they know what kind of a person he is? Do they applaud him because they know that their elections are dependent to some extent on the support of the pro-Israel lobby? I'd love to be able to crawl into the heads of some of the people saying and applauding Israel the way they do, saying things about Israel as if it's some saintly state, and see if they really believe it. I just can't. I can't imagine it.
I mean,
because I see it so transparently as this awful outlaw state. I just wonder, you know, do these Congress people really buy the crap that they are being told about it?
Jennifer, when they enter office, and whether we're talking about the Israel or the Israeli lobby or any of the others, they leave their souls outside. There is no room to serve in the office they hold and to have a conscience and to have a soul at the same time. That's an impossibility. That will go against all the laws of science, nature, everything else. Impossible. And it's the power of the Israeli lobby. If they dare confront Israel, even a tiny little bit, they will be targeted for elimination in the next election.
Yeah, and Cynthia McKinney certainly knows it.
Oh, yeah. I happen to hear it twice.
Yes.
I mean, she was elected. They beat her back with a heavily funded opposition candidate. She won again, and then they beat her back again because maybe more than anybody else who has ever served in the Congress, she really took on Israel in the lobby full force. I mean, she went at them, and she wouldn't back off. She wouldn't back down. She went at them. I mean, she really was a target that they wanted to get rid of, plain and simple. And finally, they got her out of Congress. They didn't stop her. They didn't silence her. I mean, she really is a rare figure. Somebody in Congress who really refused to leave her conscience outside, and she governed the way she really believed, not the way people would pay her off to do their bidding. She just wouldn't do that.
No, and it's actually encouraging to know that there are a few people like that, because although the numbers are small, it makes me think that there will be room for more of them in the future. You said in the beginning of the show that you detected a change in the mainstream attitude toward Israel here. I think you said something like this, and I agree. I mean, I don't think it's dramatic. I don't think we suddenly have a country that is pro-Palestinian. Well, I hate those kinds of labels in any case. But I do think that we are entering a time when more and more people are starting to question the United States' support of Israel in the Middle East and the kind of adventurous policies that it engages in along with the United States. I think more and more people are starting to say, wait a minute, what's going on here? And that is one of the few things that gives me hope today. I'm not a very optimistic person in general, but I won't give up hope. And I think seeing some of the activities, the activism that people are doing, I'm looking forward to the audacity of hope launching its sails and going to Gaza and hoping that it gets the kind of attention in the media that it should get. These are things that were inconceivable even, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. And it's very gratifying to see that more people are actually saying, I don't know if I buy this nonsense anymore.
And Jennifer, the audacity of hope is the U.S. boat that's going to break the Gaza siege.
Yes.
And in that convoy, there are 15 ships in total with
mm-hmm.
something like 1,000 activists on these ships. You know, it'll take...
Wonderful.
I mean, it's really an extraordinary thing, and another ship was just interdicted both by Egypt and Israel, the Spirit of Rachel Corrie.
Yes.
I wrote about that,
mm-hmm.
and I titled my article Trying to Kill Rachel Corrie twice.
Yes, I saw that. And I really don't know what's going to happen. I am worried about the activists on board these ships, although at the same time I wish I could have joined them. I really admire what they're doing. I think the statement that is being made with this flotilla is extremely powerful, and coming before the September vote on in the United Nations on an independent Palestinian state, I think it's all the more powerful. So it will be something that I think listeners should be paying very close attention to and should be prepared to write to their Congress people about before it even sails, to let it get to Gaza, to let it unload its goods in the port at Gaza City, because they're not getting in. We can hear about the opening of this or that crossing at Kearney or at Kerem Shalom or wherever in Gaza. The fact is, Gaza is not getting in the materials it needs to sustain itself independently. It's nowhere near there. And the flotilla, what it's bringing in is nothing more than a symbolic gesture of aid. But a very powerful one, one that is saying, this is enough. We've had enough. this has to stop. And, you know, I'm extremely happy that it's happening, that it's going to take place. At the same time, I'm nervous about the fate of the people on board that flotilla.
So am I.
Israel does not have qualms about killing people it dislikes. It has no qualms about it. It never has, as far as I can tell.
Oh, that's
exactly
right.
Nor has the United States.
Exactly right. And, of course, the end of May last year was when I think it was six ships that actually came together. There was another one that came later, got turned back with a Nobel Peace Laureate on board. That one got turned back.
The Mavi Marmara, and nine people were executed in cold blood on that ship.
Oh, yeah.
And Israel is still considered a member of the community of nations, along with the United States, of course. And people always look at me as if I'm crazy. Well, we don't expect the United States to be kicked out of the United Nations, do you? And my answer is absolutely.
Oh, we agree on that.
It's the biggest outlaw state out there.
Absolutely. Even though the U.S. Contributes something like 25% of the U.N.'s budget, and when they get mad at the U.N., Jennifer, they say, well, we're not going to make our payments. And my response, if I had anything to say about it, was keep your damn money. We don't want it, and we don't want you. And the notice will arrive in the morning that henceforth you have been expelled from this body effective this date, period, and the same one is going out to Israel, expelled from this body. I think we need to expel some others, too, I'm afraid, because there are other rogue states alive.
Sure.
I refer to an axis of evil, Jennifer. America, Israel, and the UK. UK, I think, is as bad as it was. It's the worst of it ever was during the days of its empire, when they brutalized countries to make a buck for all of their various interests. And Britain has gotten to be such a repressive place right now. Again, like America, it's not a fit place to live in. Israel is not a fit place to live in. For Jews, I'm talking about, it never was a fit place to live in for anybody, not Jews, including Christians. Christians are treated like second-class citizens, and Arab Muslims are treated like a fifth column. Their own citizens, a fifth of the population, treated like a fifth column. Let me just say one more thing. Tell listeners that I am speaking with Jennifer Lowenstein. Jennifer, so involved in this issue we're talking about. And let me also say, Jennifer, that we are trying to reach Cynthia. My studio host tells me that the line, it's a hotel line, he's been calling, has been busy. So I'll just remind my studio host, please keep ringing that number. Let's see if we can get through. I sent an email to Cynthia, if she's online and she can read it, that we've been trying and the line is busy and we haven't been able to get through, if we can even reach her. But you know, when I say the line's busy, I don't know if it's busy because the switchboard is tied up or because the area where the hotel is undergoing a bombing right now, and maybe the lines got put out of order. I don't know what's going on. But
yeah,
again, they're in a war zone and it's terrible. Can we segue to talk about Libya?
Sure.
Oh, your thoughts. I have written an awful lot about this, and I've had a fair number of interviews on it, Jennifer, and I certainly have discussed it often enough on this program and will keep doing it. But your thoughts on that atrocity that's going on?
Well, I think for me what was initially the biggest or really the most appalling statement by the U.S. government was that the involvement of the NATO forces in Libya was strictly humanitarian, that we were going in to prevent the slaughter of civilians by Gaddafi's forces, and that in every other respect, Libya was not an interest of in the interest of the United States in such a way that we'd have other motives. This was such a lie. Libya is the most important North African oil-producing state, over there, and there's no question in my mind that the decision to go into Libya was made primarily because of its status as an oil-producing state, and that the United States was not so much worried about the murder of civilians. If it worried about that, we would have an entirely different history, as it is worried about who will take Gaddafi's place if and when he is assassinated, and if we can find a dictator brutal enough to repress his own population, but to go along with the United States and its own goals. That, I think, is what we are after more than anything else. We're not there to protect innocent civilians. Now, certainly, that's not to say that there aren't servicemen and women who have in their hearts a desire to protect civilians. I actually think there are many people who get involved thinking that they are doing something good. But when it comes down to bold-faced policy, the reasons we're there have nothing to do with our concern for Libyan civilians. The reasons we're there have to do with Libyan oil.
And all the other imperial interests, Jennifer?
That go along with it. Strategic interests, interests
absolutely.
Power, regional interests. I mean, you know, the idea of creating a no-fly zone over Libya from the start was an example of grotesque hypocrisy when no no-fly zone has ever been called for over the Gaza Strip. I mean, that's all. Just that tiny example should let people know how much of a double standard we have towards our friends, those who are with us, and our enemies, those who are against us, as George Bush so uneloquently stated years ago. I mean, he divides the world up into this Manichaean good and evil, and the good guys with the white hats deserve our support, and the bad guys in the black hats deserve to be killed, and there really isn't much nuance there, at least not in terms of straightforward policy.
Let's take a brief station break. I just got a signal from my dear studio host, and indeed, we will always take a station break around this time. I mean, guests like you, Jennifer, may want to grab a sip of water. I'll just soldier on no matter what. I mean, if you want to keep going, I'll keep going all afternoon. If all the rest of the program hosts don't mind, I'm sure they do. But let's take a brief break, and then we'll come right back.
Okay.
You are listening to A Progressive Moment on the Progressive Radio Network. Did you miss your favorite show on Progressive Radio Network? Well, no need to worry. We have all of our shows archived on our website. Go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives and find the show you're looking for.
I'm so excited to be on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'll be able to talk to you live, answer your questions, and work with you for your own patient rights. Tune in every Sunday at 5 p.m. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. See you on Sunday, 5 p.m.
South of the border.
Are you one of the millions caught up in that first world rat race? Well, I used to be. I'm John Mueller, host of the Expat Files, where we discuss what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down in Latin America. Can you really live like a king down here on a crummy Social Security check? What about starting a business or buying a house or love and romance? Just tune in Monday and Wednesday at 8 p.m. and send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And to listen to any of my past shows, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives and click on the link to the Expat Files. Nos vemos.
I kiss the smile upon her face.
Come to the Progressive Radio Network each day for the best progressive minds in the world.
Oh, let me jump back in. Have we connected with Cynthia? Cynthia, are you on?
Yes, we have.
Oh, marvelous. We kept trying for 30 minutes, and the lines were busy, busy, busy. I mean, I was saying on air that I had no idea whether the switchboard was tied up or maybe a bomb hit the wires and knocked out the lines. I mean, who can know? Who can know? Oh,
well,
welcome. Welcome. I'm also on with Jennifer Lowenstein from Madison. And Jennifer is so active for the Palestinian cause and all the other things that she and I occasionally discuss on this program. We were talking about Libya, but you're there, and you've been there for days. Tell my listeners what you're seeing firsthand, what they won't read
in
the New York Times.
Well, I can tell you that I'm seeing a humanitarian crisis unfold as a result of NATO's actions. I am in Tripoli. I have been outside to various other smaller towns. I went to visit the family of one of the black Libyans. I mean, even to have to describe someone as a black Libyan, you know, it's just horrible. But I went to the home to hear the story of how the Libyan NATO allies, the rebels, targeted him because of his darker skin color, and called the family on the phone and said, "We got your son." And when they asked, well, you know, what did he do? They said, well, he didn't do anything, but we're going to kill him. And then told them, look on Al Jazeera and see what we do. I mean, this is the kind of behavior that the colonial powers that are the members of NATO, this is what they are supporting,
and it's
absolutely horrible. Of course, I was here during the most intense bombardments. One was the very first day when they bombed between 26 and 29 times, and then just a few days ago, and this is in Tripoli, they bombed 89 times from 11 o'clock in the morning was the first bomb that went off. And it was sustained all day, throughout the day, all evening, all night. And 11:30 at night, they had bombed 89 times. They had dropped 89 bombs.
It's unbelievable.
So now, how much are we paying for this, as opposed to paying for teachers and school books and
healthcare,
things that people need? Health care. I read that the city of Providence, Rhode Island, laid off or is in the process of laying off every one of their public school teachers, every one of them. So aren't there children in Providence, Rhode Island? But the priorities of this government are just all upside down. And then some Twitter came out today saying that I was Gaddafi's best friend. I am the best friend of the truth, And that's what we have come here to uncover, because you're definitely not going to get it from the mighty Wurlitzer. And that's what Frank Wisner called the ability of the CIA and various U.S. government organs to play the organ of public opinion so that everyone dances to the tune of the mighty Wurlitzer. And that is what is happening today.
It is really shocking, and it's the worst that I've seen in my lifetime. The big power interests always had first dibs on all of the resources and benefits that this country can bestow on anybody or any group. But today, Cynthia and Jennifer, it has really reached such an extreme where I can look back over my many years and all the injustices that I remember. I'm old enough to remember very, very well the civil rights struggles in the 1950s and 60s. I don't remember anything about the labor struggles in the 30s because I was just a baby. I knew nothing. I just read about it and learned about it later. But the civil rights struggles, I remember seeing that stuff, reading about it, seeing pictures, even when we got television, to seeing some of the horrors that went on streets, and yet the courage of these people and so on. But everything that went on then, it just exploded to something much bigger. We keep demonizing people. We're fighting more wars than ever. We're destroying more lives. We're causing more harm on a greater global scale than ever before, including at home. And I just shake my head. And I know, we know, there's only one way to confront this, and that's for ordinary human beings to go at it themselves, to understand that the powers that run this country, and of course they don't just want to run this country, they want to run the world, and they will kill anybody who will get in their way to stop them unless we confront them and refuse to back down, just like the glorious human rights activists in the 1960s. I mean, some of them put their lives on the line, and if they hadn't done that, those rights never would have been won. Sadly, they've been lost now. But it took tremendous courage against great odds to go against the system and beat it at its own game. It can happen again, and it's ordinary people that have to do it, and we better do it, I repeat all the time, because we are literally seeing this country turned into the most brutal kind of despotic police state nobody would want to live in, and it's coming, and I can see it coming, and I know it's coming, and unfortunately, I'm going to see it in my lifetime unless we stop it.
Cynthia, may I ask you a question?
Right.
Yes, one of the questions that I've had in my mind for a long time is why it is that it seems the American public, generally speaking, does not make the connection between what the United States is doing overseas and the vast amounts of money it is pouring into foreign wars and the state of our domestic economy. It almost seems as if the two issues haven't been connected in the public mind, and I realize that's a generalization. And I wanted to get your opinion on that as a congresswoman or former congresswoman. What do you think is the reason that people are not making this connection?
Well, I think that people are increasingly making the connection.
Mm-hmm.
If the Zogby poll is correct, the most recent Zogby poll is correct, 60% of the American people are against this adventure that is causing death and destruction in Libya.
Yes,
now,
that's encouraging.
That means that our president has made a decision to go against the interests of his party, to go against the interests of the United States, to go against the public opinion. Now, why would an elected official do such a thing? I think we need to understand what the motivations are
the real motivations, not the stated ones, because the
yes.
stated ones are just lies.
Right.
That's what we have to understand. Who's moving behind the scenes?
Who's benefiting?
That's right. That's right.
And
it's certainly not the Libyan people.
No. And what's your answer? Who
and
do
it's
you
not
think
the American people.
No. Who are the people benefiting from this kind of intervention in Libya? Is it oil corporations? Is it just big business in general? Is it the gun belt, the military economy? I mean, I assume it's parts of all of these. But who are the real beneficiaries?
Well, I think we have to go back to what Ray McGovern said. OIL. It's not just oil. I mean,
no.
Libya's oil was going to Europe already.
Yes.
So it's not the oil. It's something else. And it's the something else. It's at the time there were also discussions about the Mediterranean organization of states. And the Europeans had proposed that all of the European countries be involved in this organization, and just on the African side, just the countries that are on the Mediterranean littoral. Well, that's clearly not fair, and so it was Gaddafi who said, well, if it's all of Europe, then it's going to be all of Africa. And the Europeans didn't appreciate that. It's almost the same situation as when I asked the Bush administration, you know, what did it know and when did it know it about the events of September 11th? Because clearly that was not a question that was appropriate for a black member of Congress from Georgia to start questioning their government. No black people are allowed to question the United States government. And so here you've got this African leader, and, you know, he got out of his place.
Yeah, I what you said about oil resonates a bit, but I understand that one of the things that the United States would like to get from the bombing of Libya is a dictator in place, in Gaddafi's place, who is more America-friendly, who will engage with American oil corporations. I mean, and Libya was, to some extent, involved with Armand Hammer, for example, for many years. So it's not entirely... oil plays a role. What I wonder, though, is... who else are the beneficiaries? Is it
Israel is involved in this?
And what about
the
aerospace industry, the weapons builders, the weapons manufacturers? I assume they're getting a piece of this pie, whatever you want to call it.
I think that everyone is sitting back and counting the spoils of war, the booty.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got the French, the Canadians, you've got, the Brits, the Americans, and everyone, the Italians, and you've got Qataris, you've got Emiratis, you've got these new players who are all looking at how they can benefit from the death and destruction that is being rained upon the people of Libya right now.
Well, and the same thing in a different context, of course, is taking place in Yemen, perhaps even more dangerously so, because Yemen has such a strategic importance for the United States, as does Bahrain. I see both of these situations as increasingly dangerous, because the United States is not willing to let go and to step aside. It certainly doesn't want the pro-democracy forces to win. That's the last thing in the world the United States wants, is for the UAE and Qatar and Bahrain to become democratic, freedom-loving states. Because if you have that kind of a state in power, you have public opinion guiding political policies. And and if public opinion is going to determine foreign policy, the Americans will no longer be welcome there. So we don't want democracy in these countries. It's a lie.
Or you just use the media and control public opinion. And that's exactly what they would like to have, the veil of democracy without the substance of democracy, just as we have in the United States and have always had. As an African American, I can laugh when they say that there's democracy. We weren't even included in the Constitution. Where's the role of indigenous people? So, you know, the United States, we have to understand the history of our country and put into the language that is used today, also the actions and the behaviors and the policies that accompany these very pronouncements.
I see it happening, and but what I also see is a region, and particularly the Middle East. I think North Africa is increasingly involved, but a region that is inching closer and closer to real disaster if somebody or some people don't steer things in a more sane direction. And that's not happening in the United States. We're not...
Well, you know, here's another thing, too. The fishermen... The Libyan fishermen are being chased out of their own territorial waters by NATO.
Well, that sounds very familiar. Sounds like
it does sound familiar. And then, you know, I looked out the window today. I've been looking at the clouds all day today, and they're like dark gray clouds in the sky, and there's this haze. I've been in California when there was the forest fires, and the sky just has this black particulate matter in it. And so now the clouds here are dark, and they're full of the debris from the bombing. And, you know, they are using depleted uranium is what I understand. And they've got they're using the bunker buster, they're using Tomahawk missiles, and all of this stuff is now being inhaled by the people. And you can look at the sky, and you know, this was a place that was clean. Well, it's not clean anymore.
Well, again, that goes back to what we were talking about just a minute ago, and this idea that somehow in the media here, we hear echoes of our policymakers talking about going into Libya or Yemen or Bahrain and wanting to support the protesters who want democracy. That's obviously not what we want to support, because public opinion in these countries is very anti-American. The people of Yemen and Syria and Bahrain and Libya, Syria, of course, is a much different situation in some ways, are not waiting for the Americans to come save them. It's the last thing in the world they want. As you said, now in Libya, we're polluting the air, we're polluting the environment. It makes me think of what we've already done to Iraq, which is...
And what we've already done to our own environment.
That's
right. You know, just the military bases alone, it would take us generations to do cleanup there. That would be a tremendous project for our civil engineers and the population that needs employment. Instead, we're not cleaning up anything. We're raining down death and destruction. And at some point, the American people just have to say, I've had enough. Or like Fannie Lou Hamer said, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. Sick and tired of war.
Sick and tired of war.
Can I ask a question?
When are we going to get media programs in the mainstream that tell people what's really happening. That's what I want to know. When is that going to happen? Certainly not going to happen as long as people...
When we stop buying the New York Times and the Washington Post. If you look at what they did, I just go back to the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and then there was the trial in 1999 where they said in the trial there was testimony from Bill Shapp, and he said approximately 30% of the CIA budget is dedicated to buying journalists and news outlets, and New York Times said, St. Louis Times, Dispatch, Atlanta Constitution, all of these newspapers were...
Well, and it's important to me, and I'm sure to you too, because what I think is that if the average American, if there is such a thing, if most Americans had any idea what was being done in their name, there's no way they would support it. When a report came out on December 31st, 2010, that the consequences of the U.S. bombing campaign in Fallujah in 2004 were worse than the consequences of Hiroshima, that never made it to the media in the United States. And that wasn't something written by an amateur. It was written by the International Journal of Environmental Toxicology. I think if people knew facts like that, they would be appalled. They wouldn't vote for Bush or Obama or Clinton. They wouldn't want anything to do with these people and the kind of interests they serve. And that's what really bothers me when I see how strong the grip of the media is over the people in this country.
But it's beginning to weaken a little bit. And more people discovering alternate sites. This program has gained the following. Others like it have gained followings. And people begin to realize that when they watch CNN or read the New York Times, they're getting managed news, deliberately suppressing the most important facts. I wanted to get in one question as the hour is just about up, Cynthia. My understanding, and you're there, is that whether deliberately or accidentally or whatever, there have been a lot of civilian targets struck and badly damaged or destroyed, including schools, including hospitals, including private residences. Have you seen that with your own eyes?
I've seen that with my own eyes, yes. And what I've heard, and I just left the Non-Governmental Fact-Finding Commission that delivered a letter to the government to ask for unfettered access to all of the bombing sites. And I understand that there are mosques, universities, residences. I've seen the residences. I've seen the hospital. I've seen there was a school for disabled children that was hit. I've seen that, and of course Bab al-Azizia, which is the compound that was hit by the United States in 1986, killing the daughter of Colonel Gaddafi. And there, the people are just so outraged, they've decided that they're going to move there. And so they brought tents, and they have set up that place, and they have a party. They have a party every night. My dream is to have a peace concert there. But they have a party every night there, and NATO bombs and kills people at that site where they know there's only civilians.
And we have such precision-guided weapons. How can this be by mistake?
I don't think it's by mistake.
Well,
I think it's intentional.
We have guided missiles and misguided men. That's what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. told us.
I like that. I'm going to remember that. Because, see, I don't believe any of this is by mistake.
I heard a statistic that for every militant, quote-unquote, whatever a militant is, that a drone attack kills, the same attack kills 50 non-combatant civilians.
Well, and I remember hearing and seeing the same kinds of things in the Gaza Strip during Cast Lead, where Israel would bomb the UN compound in Gaza City and then claim it was a mistake. That compound takes up an entire block. That wasn't a mistake. that was intentional. When are we going to start?
Absolutely
intentional. And the same thing is happening in Libya, and the same thing will be happening in Yemen. When are people going to wake up and say, this is not going to happen any longer, not in my name?
Taxpayers are paying for this, and because we're doing it, there's no money left over, we're told, for basic needs, for basic social needs of people who don't have them, who don't have jobs, who've lost their homes. There's no money left. We're broke because we have to buy these missiles and bombs to kill these people, and that's our money doing this.
In wars that can't be won.
When are we going to get mad about that? We're out of time.
Well, I'm already mad, and I know you are too.
I will stay mad. Gloriously mad.
We need organized, mobilized madness.
Absolutely. I thank you both, Jennifer Lowenstein from Madison, Cynthia McKinney from Tripoli, and I'm Steve Lindman at my humble abode in Chicago. To be continued, absolutely to be continued. My great thanks to you both.
Thank you, Stephen, for having me, and it's great talking to you, Jennifer.
Oh, it's just wonderful.
And thank you, Cynthia, for being in Tripoli.
Okay.
Real courage.
Bye-bye.
Real courage in the line of fire. Join us again next week. You know when. Thursdays, weekends. We'll do the same thing every single time. News you need. Discussion that will explain it all to you. You won't get that on CNN and the rest of them. You know that.